We've taken a look at each kind of psalm in the 150 psalms, among the 150. And now it's time to sort of back off a little bit and look at the collection as a whole to gain a richer understanding of what these many psalms with their many voices together say theologically. And there are a number of common themes that emerge out of the psalms as a whole. One of the key themes is that Yahweh is always acknowledged as the true King of Israel. This comes through in the royal psalms, it comes through in the Psalms of Zion, but it also comes through in other psalms as well, that when we praise God, we're speaking about the one who is the true King of Israel, but more than that, we're speaking about the Lord, the Creator of heaven and earth, who has chosen Israel as the vehicle by which to rule over the nations of the earth. Not that Israel should go out and conquer all nations, but certainly that all nations ought to come through Israel to Yahweh and know the best that can be had in their lives and their situations, in their own contemporary political and national and cultural affairs. Secondly, Zion is Yahweh's capital city. We've looked at the songs of Zion, and the songs of Zion are themselves reflections of the fact that Yahweh has come down to make a residence in Jerusalem, a place on earth. Why would that be? Well, the story of the Bible goes like this, and this is part of the early chapters, and it goes all the way through the consummation, through the book of Revelation, that the world, the universe, was created by God. But that the earth, planet earth, was the location of God's most favored part of creation, the human race. And the human race, among all of the other dimensions of creation, alone possesses what we call the image of God. And the image of God is the ability of humankind to reflect the creative, the cultural, the moral vision of God, the ability to echo back in loving relationships the deepening of a sense of self and purpose. Now, if that's true, then what's also true is that humankind generally has lost touch with its creator. Because God made us in God's own image in order to have the ability to love, love cannot be forced. Therefore, humankind has freedom to choose, and in its choices has generally affirmed its own existence and denied its relationship with God. For that reason, God had to break into human consciousness, human history, human endeavors, human experiences, and express God's own self to us once again. How would God do this? For this reason, God chooses Israel as a small but significant player in the world of ancient times, and plants this nation in the one spot of real estate among all of the nations where it could not be overlooked. You see, Canaan, Palestine, is this small sliver of land that forms the bridge between Africa, Asia, and Europe. And the trade routes and the caravans and the conquest routes and the communication lines of the ancient world all had to pass ultimately through Canaan. So God teaches God's people, the Israelites, God's ways, the covenant, and plants them there in order that they might be a witness to the nations. It's not the New Testament that becomes missional. It's the Old Testament already. The actions of God with Israel that are very missional. God is seeking to reclaim a relationship with all nations of the earth and does so through the nation of Israel. Therefore, Zion is Yahweh's capital city. If God is to reappear among God's people on earth, there must be a locus of that encounter. There must be a place of connection. And Zion becomes that place where God chooses to step out of heaven and participate in the direct actions of humankind. So Yahweh comes to Zion. Zion becomes that symbol of a fortress, that symbol of things done right, that symbol of righteousness, embodied, incarnate in on planet Earth, and all of the nations then are able to see it. Another key theme in the book of Psalms is that the covenant with David authenticates the right of this family, the Davidic family, to rule. Remember that when David was anointed as king, he was still a boy, and Saul was still the king. You can see this in 1 Samuel. David was called into the house and service of Saul, but Saul increasingly saw that David would be a better king than either him or his son Jonathan. And so David was outlawed from the palaces and sent as a scoundrel in the wilderness, being chased down by Saul's men. Eventually, Saul and Jonathan will die in battle with the Philistines, and then the anointing of David as king becomes true, and David is raised to the office of royal ambassador, to the office of king, first in his own community, that of the tribe of Judah, but then later through the whole nation, the nation of Israel. As David rules, and his rule is very different from, similar in some respects, but very different from that of Saul. It's a long rule and a righteous rule, and he's called a man after God's own heart. He acknowledges that he is not the true king of Israel, that Yahweh is the true king of Israel, and therefore Yahweh ought to be seen in this form by those who constantly participate in the daily activities of Jerusalem and the life of the nation. So David brings the Ark of the Covenant, the portable throne of God from the times of Israel's wanderings in the wilderness and its stop at Mount Sinai, the creation of the tabernacle, the place of God, the tent of meeting. The throne of God is the center of God's presence in that place where God comes down and visibly sits on the mercy seat and gives rule or direction to the nation through, of course, the high priest, through, of course, Moses and Joshua and others. David brings the Ark of the Covenant to Jerusalem as the symbol of Yahweh's direct rule. And David wants to build a permanent palace or home for this true king of Israel. And David is told that it's not for him to do that, but his descendant. His hands are hands of war. His descendants' hands will be hands of peace. If that's the case, then David is thankful, but Yahweh is also thankful. And through the prophet Nathan, the word comes in 2 Samuel 7 that because David has desired to build a house for God, God has chosen to build a house for David. From this time forth, even forever, David will always have an heir on the throne ruling God's people. That becomes the theme of these Psalms, that David's family is the rightful rulers, and no other family ought to usurp that authority, and this family, as it rules in righteousness, expresses the best of what the relationship between the nation and its God, its true king, is all about. But in that context, a third idea of the theology in the Psalms as well, that while Yahweh is understood to be the great king of Israel, Yahweh is also understood to be the ruler over all the nations. If, in fact, the purpose for Israel's existence is to be the witness of the Creator to the nations around, then it's important for the other nations around to understand that they are under the rule of Yahweh. Now, that doesn't always happen in a visible way. Through the reign of Solomon, it came awfully close because Solomon had an influence on all of the nations of the ancient Near East in a way that no other ruler has had before or since. But this was symbolic of what ultimately would be the case, that one would be born from the family of David who would rule over all the nations, and that would be Jesus. So already in the Old Testament, while the other nations are larger and more powerful and seemingly more dominant in many ways throughout the politics and economics of the ancient Near East, it is really Israel who gives evidence of the one true ruler. We can see this in other places, in the prophets and throughout the writings. There are many references to this, but these Psalms also echo that same theme. Yahweh is understood to be ruler over all the nations. Israel's purpose, fourthly, is to be a witness to those nations, and that's why Psalms like Psalm 67, bless us, then the nations will be blessed. Come upon us, then others will see. How it happens to Israel in God's divine favor will be an evidence of God's divine favor to all the nations. So Israel is not to remain closed off to itself, is not intended to be a separated nation, isolated from others. It's to remain uniquely tied to God through the covenant laws and shaping ceremonies and cultural expressions of its relationship with God in order to be a witness to the nations who come by through these trade routes and conquest routes and communication lines. They're supposed to come through Israel and say, wow, what is going on here? Something unique, something wonderful. We'd like whatever you have. And the Psalms express that idea that whatever Israel has is God's goodness intended for all the nations. Another concept, theological concept, is that the divine blessing is linked to covenant faithfulness, and punishment for Israel is linked to covenant curses. This goes back to the covenant documents themselves at Mount Sinai, where God enters into a unique relationship with the nation of Israel that involves many blessings, but that also stipulates a certain kind of curse that happens to the nation during those times when the nation turns away from Yahweh or forgets its relationship, its unique relationship with Yahweh. Then will come the curses like running in front of your enemies, being chased by other nations, even the possibility of exile, deportation, losing your riches and your wealth, no longer having a sense of self and your nation or your cities being toppled. Those are all part of the curses. And so you see a number of the Psalms which reflect bad times happening either to the psalmist individually or to the nation as a whole, and then connecting that to the covenant so that the covenant curses are in fact being played out. Now, remember, God, the covenant blessings in order that you can provide deliverance from this. A very interesting connection throughout all of the Psalms in that regard. Also connected to that, another theme is the idea of laments being based on the right to plead for God's covenant faithfulness, even when the people have sinned. And this is quite striking. Why does David, why do others of the psalmists think they have a right to state their case before God? Why can they be so confident that even when they are being punished or it seems as if they're being forgotten by God, that God's going to show up and do something good? And here's this marvelous thing of covenant. Covenant. We have to think about covenant. When the Israelites were parked at Mount Sinai and God was giving the covenant, not just the Ten Commandments, but look at Exodus 20 through 24, the covenant as a larger framework of cultural life and national existence to Moses so that he could take it down. Remember what was happening at the base of the mountain, that the Israelites were saying to Aaron, Moses' brother, the head of the Levites and the priests, where did God go? Where did my brother, where did your brother go? Well, who's going to lead us now? And the outcome was the golden calf and the worship of other gods. And remember when Moses came down from the mountain, Exodus 32, 33, and 34, that of course God was angry. And after a while, Moses went to talk with God, and God said, you know, I don't think this is working out. Maybe we just forget these people. I like you, Moses. You and I, we should go together. We should start a new thing. And what does Moses say to God? Moses says, you can't do that. He says, you can't do that because you formed a covenant with these people. And no matter what happens to them, you are tied to their future. You are tied to their actions. You are tied to them from here to eternity because you love them, because you want to be with them, because they are your people. And so laments throughout the Psalms are based upon the right of people who belong to the covenant community to plead for God's covenant faithfulness even when the people themselves have sinned and done bad things. Because you are our God, we can come and say, make it right, help us out, do the right thing. It's a very powerful thing, and that's where the laments throughout the Psalms get their strength and their force. And praise, finally, is an extension of the great witness intended to be communicated through to Israel. Praise. What's going on? God's in charge. What's going on? We love God. What's going on? Look at the glory of God in the heavens around us. Look at the glory of God in the earth. Praise is the song of worship, the great song of worship between God's people and God himself. And that's why it's one of the most prevalent and profound expressions in all of the Psalms. A few ideas as you read through the Psalms, and I certainly encourage you to read them again and again and again. How can we make the best use of these Psalms? Well, read them for the poetic images. Psalm 19, the heavens declare the glory of God, and God speaks through the law. Psalm 29, where the great storm arises, and out of the storm we begin to sense the power of God, and in God's temple all cry glory. Psalm 104, where we go to the heights of the mountains and look out to the seas and say, wow, look around us at everything that's praising God. Enjoy the poetic images. Rest in the gracious comfort. Psalm 23, Psalm 139. The Lord is my shepherd. I was formed and fashioned in my mother's womb by God. God will never leave me. God will never forsake me. Marvel in the compact simplicity of some of the Psalms. Psalm 1, which expresses wisdom about a godly life. And Psalm 131, which simply talks about resting in the idea, my heart is not haughty, my eyes are not lifted up, I do not delight in things too big for me, but I rest confidently like a baby in its mother's arms before my God. The Psalms can be used to vocalize sorrow for sinfulness when you or I do things wrong. We can go to Psalm 32 or Psalm 51, that great psalm that David wrote after he sinned with Bathsheba, and find words to express our sorrow for our sins before God. The Psalms can express spiritual longing, 42 and 43, which together give that recurring refrain, why are you cast down within me, my soul? Hope in God, for he is my help and my confidence. Or Psalm 73, a psalm of Asaph, in which Asaph remembers that it's not appearances in life that truly matter, but one's heart relationship with God. Beautiful psalms both. Ponder great evil and pain. Psalm 22. You can't get through the first two-thirds of this psalm without thinking about Jesus, without thinking about great pain and great difficulty. It starts out, my God, why have you forsaken me? And Psalm 88, which is that deeply troubling psalm in which one reflects on all who have forsaken me. Has God also forsaken me? There's almost the idea that maybe that's the case, and yet the hope that that's not the case. Ponder great evil and pain. Or gain a moral compass through those psalms which are wisdom and priestly instruction. Psalm 15, who shall ascend to the hill of God? Who shall stand in his courts? And then a list of things, he who has clean hands and a pure heart, who doesn't delight in evil things. Or Psalm 107, which has four specific scenes in which people are troubled. And God brings deliverance, and they find themselves returning to the center point of their lives, to their relationship with God. And probably most of all, to learn the language of praise. Psalm 100, Psalm 145, Psalm 150, many of the other psalms, particularly near the end of the collection, in which the praise of God is expressed in so many delightful and powerful ways. The Psalms exude great praise. Use the Psalms in worship, in personal devotional life. Read them well. It's one of the reasons I wrote my book, Hear Me, O God, reflecting on every one of the 150 Psalms, thinking about the context and the meaning and the implications for how these things resonate with my life before God. More on these things as well in Covenant Documents, the book that I wrote about how to understand and get into the Bible as a whole.